The 2016-2017 Chautauqua Lecture Series at Eastern Kentucky University explores the challenging and age-old theme of order and chaos. On this week's Eastern Standard, we'll meet some of the speakers who've been to campus so far during this academic year.
We have a country that was essentially 100% indigenous peoples, and with a few hundred years, we're about 1%, close to 2%, 1.5%. That's like Africa, ground down to or massacred to 0.5% Africa.
On this week's Eastern Standard, we're featuring the Chautauqua Lecture Series, and we'll have exclusive interviews with some of its guest speakers. This week's show is recorded, and therefore we're not taking calls during the show. But you're still welcome to write to us at wekueasternstandard@gmail.com, post a comment to the Facebook page, or send a tweet at WEKUEST. It's time for Eastern Standard, right after the latest news from NPR. From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen. This year marks the 17th year of the Chautauqua Lecture Series on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University. The theme for this year's series is Order and Chaos, looking at this age-old issue from the point of view of philosophy and psychology, national and global politics, personal struggles and cultural identities, artistic and musical expression, evolutionary theory, and cosmology. Some heavy topics here. This year, the series features 16 distinguished scholars, critics, scientists, journalists, poets, artists, and musicians from the Commonwealth of Kentucky, from across the nation, and from across the ocean, plus, of course, the always fascinating National Juried Art Exhibition on the series theme, and that art exhibition actually underway this week. In the studio with me for this program to get us started and tell us more about the Chautauqua Lecture Series is Eric Liddell, coordinator of the series at Eastern Kentucky University. Eric, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
We did this last year, and I think it's really an opportunity for us to talk here about this series that I don't think always gets the fanfare or recognition that it deserves, although it's a growing program, a growing event or series of events, actually, the Chautauqua series. Can we go back to the beginning? Some of our listeners know this, but many certainly do not. What is the Chautauqua series? Where does this Chautauqua name come from, and what's it all about?
Sure. Absolutely, John. And it's a pleasure to be here again and to do this next year. And it's true that, you know, we're still in the process of growing and promoting the series, although we have a great outreach, not just here on campus, but across central Kentucky. We get a lot of people coming out to our events from fairly far and wide. But the Chautauqua series here at EKU began in 2000 under the leadership of Bruce McLaren, after whom we now have a distinguished lecture named every year. And he ran the series for about 10 years and passed it off to Professor Ming Nguyen of the Department of Philosophy, who ran it for about 4 years. And I've been on board for 2 years now as the coordinator. But the idea of Chautauqua in general goes back to the late 19th century in the United States when all over the country, really, public or civic education movements cropped up sort of in, you might say, imitation of what was going on at the Chautauqua Institute in New York, in upstate New York. And so the name Chautauqua is most closely associated with that place and with the activities that go on there. But it really spread far and wide and pretty quickly, and it became what President Theodore Roosevelt called the most American of institutions, because it really was citizens getting together to identify important questions, problems, themes, practical concerns from home economics to morality to temperance, et cetera. You know, at the time, Chautauqua presentations tended to reflect the concerns and themes of the day. And so these cropped up, and people got together, and they gave lectures, they gave performances, and so on, to help each other live a rich and full life, to challenge their ideas and their understanding of the world, and to improve in that most American of ways by collaborating and innovating and sharing ideas in a civic and civil form. And so we try to, in a certain sense, imitate that here at EKU, where we always choose a particular theme for a given year. Of course, this year's theme is order and chaos. And when we do that, You know, we try to select a theme that, in a sense, is timeless. So past themes have included human rights, love, war and peace, freedom, beauty, etc. But something that also, you know, continues to speak to us in our contemporary situation.
This theme of order and chaos seems to be very timely for 2016, 2017, given the presidential election and what that has meant to our nation and to the world. Was there a thought to that this was going to be a somewhat chaotic year?
There was. I don't know that anybody predicted how chaotic it would actually become, you know, in the wrangling and so on, the wrestling that went on in the American election, for example. But, you know, we get together every year, about 20 or 25 of us from across the university. That's to say, people who are on the Chautauqua Advisory Committee. And we basically have a brainstorming session where we talk about ideas that are of interest and are of concern to us. And last year, it's true, the election was on people's minds. International terrorism and security issues were on people's mind. So a combination of things produced a sense that we should tackle this theme of order and chaos, the relationship between the two, the very thin line, you might say, sometimes between those two things. And, you know, it emerged and then was given to me. And, you know, I do my research. I get suggestions from members of the committee throughout the year. And then I move forward with invitations. And it has proved a productive theme this year. You know, we've had people come and talk about international terrorism, talk about perspectives on the then still underway American election, talk about cosmology, which you mentioned in your setup, and talk about political and social issues and personal issues as well. You know, the order and chaos in our lives in a variety of ways.
And I should explain to our listeners that this is a recorded program. Eric Liddell of the Chautauqua Lecture Series at EKU is with me in the studio. And this is a program in which we're going to bring you some of the interviews that I have had the pleasure of doing with some of the guests who've come in for Chautauqua Lectures this year. Again, the second year that we've kind of done this in an orderly fashion. When folks come into town or they make their presentations from here within the Commonwealth, we invite them to come to the studio, spend 10, 15, 20 minutes with me in the studio, and then we put together a program such as this. And today we're going to meet four of those speakers. We'll tell you more about those speakers in just a few minutes as we talk a little bit about the background of the Chautauqua series. But this is not a live show. We're unable to take any listener calls at this time, but you're certainly welcome to send us an email. Let us know what you think about what we're doing here. Your suggestions for Chautauqua Lectures, your reactions, if you've ever attended one of these Chautauqua Lectures on the campus, write to us at wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send us a tweet at wekuest. You can leave a voicemail message, 859-622-1657. Eric Liddell, back to the concept of the Chautauqua Lecture Series. I mean, lectures are kind of the lifeblood of universities. So that's what happens every day. People go to classrooms or lecture halls or auditoria and hear presentations. But these Chautauqua Lectures go beyond. They're not part of the regular curriculum for anybody. Is that correct?
That's correct. And our lectures, which are given by often very top people internationally and nationally in their fields, do touch upon and derive from very specific expertise. But they reach out to touch the audience and to touch our minds and our imaginations in ways that resonate with all of us as human beings. And so while we have experts in, say, physics or in biology or in politics coming to give talks on their work, on their books, on their research, they take this as an opportunity to really make connections that are interdisciplinary and that go beyond. And it's an enhancement and a supplement and a wonderful way for our students and our faculty and our staff and people here in Central Kentucky to, you know, add to their own intellectual development. All of our lectures are free and open to the public. It's not just a campus event, and you never have to pay anything to come to a Chautauqua lecture or performance, because some of our presenters give performances as well, poetry readings, musical concerts, etc. And You know, it really is a way, I think, I kind of think of it as one of the jewels, right, in EKU's crown. It's a wonderful series. It's one of the things that attracted me to EKU when I was invited to come here for a campus interview.
What I've seen of the audiences, they seem to be mixed audiences of students and folks from the community, faculty, staff. Talk about that. Is there a target audience for these programs?
The target audience is as wide as we can make it. You know, in recent years, I have undertaken a Twitter promotion campaign in addition to Facebook event campaigns and a variety of more traditional forms of promotion to get the word out. But generally, yes, we get a mixture of faculty and staff and students who often are coming to the Chautauqua lectures in connection with their courses. So they may be asked to write short responses or reflections upon the material. And I'm delighted when I do see students in the audience taking notes, coming up to the mic and asking questions afterwards. In that way, I know that what we're doing in Chautauqua is connecting with the educational development of our students and, in that sense, the curriculum of EKU. But we do want to appeal to people far and wide. I think this, you know, is a great opportunity here on the radio to connect with people out in the listening area who may or may not be able to get to campus easily, but can, you know, perhaps check our website, www.chautauqua.eku.edu, or find us on Facebook or Twitter, and make a point of getting in for a lecture once in a while when it is possible to experience, in a certain sense, the magic of the Chautauqua lecture in person.
We need to take a break in just a few moments, but let me ask you before we do that, has there been one so far this year that has been your favorite of the speakers? How many? Have there been six, seven lectures so far this year?
Well, I have to look at my notes to count. I think we've had
we have four that we're going to present today.
Lectures and a special event with EKU professors. Well, I would have to say my favorite is has been this year, Joy Harjo, the Muskogee poet, real force in literature. I think she's just one of our greatest poetic voices today. And she came and gave a mixed lecture of storytelling, poetry reading, performance involving flute and saxophone and singing. And it was spellbinding. It was absolutely wonderful. And it was a real highlight for me to meet her and to host her here at EKU.
I had a delightful and informative conversation with her. Sadly, we were only able to get her on the telephone prior to her talk, but we're going to hear about 6 or 7 minutes of an interview with Joy Harjo during this week's Eastern Standard program. But coming up in just a few moments, we're going to hear from Canadian independent journalist, historian, and author Gwen Dyer. That's the first segment we'll be presenting for you on this week's show. We're kind of doing a little review of some of the folks who've been on campus at Eastern Kentucky University for the 2016-2017 Chautauqua Lecture Series. Eric Liddell, coordinator of the series, with me in the studio. And as I said, we're glad to hear from you, your reactions to these guests, your reaction to the concept of the Chautauqua Lecture Series, your suggestions. Eric is open to hearing from the public in general. Write to us, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKUEST or leave us a voicemail message, which could end up on the WEKU listener feedback. 859-622-1657. We'll be right back with more of Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. The 2016-2017 Chautauqua Lecture Series on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, Order and Chaos is the theme. That's what we are talking about on today's program with Eric Liddell, coordinator of the Chautauqua Series on campus. And we're now going to hear from some of the folks who have been on campus this year and let you hear just a sample. We really don't have the time. I spent 15 or 20 minutes talking with each of them. Their talks were an hour, longer than that oftentimes.
Plus question and answer.
Yeah. So there's no way you can really experience these lectures except by attending them. So we'll certainly give a blatant promotion for attending future Chautauqua lectures on the campus. But Eric Liddell, let's talk about this speaker, Gwen Dyer, a Canadian independent journalist. And a lot of these folks, I have to admit, before I meet them, I've never heard of them before. Tell us why Gwen Dyer was invited to speak.
Yeah. Well, Gwynne Dyer had been on my radar since I was an undergraduate because his column was published in the local newspaper where I lived back in Canada. And so I was familiar with his work, his writing, his on-the-ground journalism of a kind of old-fashioned, gritty sort. And when I started doing my research on order and chaos and international terrorism and security, he popped up. His most recent book called Don't Panic, ISIS, Terror, and Today's Middle East was an obvious fit for the series. But beyond that, he is an expert, historian and journalist on issues of international conflict. And I knew that he would come and give an absolutely magisterial presentation, which he did, for 45 minutes to an hour with no notes in the EKU Center for the Arts, where we had to switch to at the last minute just because of some campus issues. And it was an absolutely wonderful talk, which I don't think our president, Mike Benson, will mind me saying. He thought, as a Middle Eastern historian himself, was one of the best that he had ever heard.
Wow.
And so that's the kind of quality that we bring to the Chautauqua stage, and I'm quite proud of that.
Well, I certainly enjoyed and, again, was informed, learned a lot by chatting with Gwynne Dyer. Again, the 2015 book, Don't Panic, ISIS, Terrorism, and Today's Middle East, and that was the topic of his talk on October 20th.
Terrorism is a technique which is always smaller than it looks. I mean, it's a low cost, relatively small numbers of people involved, and yet you get an enormous effect because, of course, it's structured to get the media's attention. The media then carries it, inflates it into a much bigger threat than it actually is. And the people who carry out the attacks then get the benefit of whatever it was they hoped to stampede the government into doing that will ultimately serve their purposes. So, you know, terror attacks are always smaller than they look when the media is finished with them. This is not a major threat. It's never been a major threat. Even counting 9/11, it has never been what you would call an existential threat to the West or to the United States or even to your average citizen, except for the very few who actually do get killed, which is pretty existential. We overreact. We overreact all the time. Don't panic.
On what basis can you say that? Is that because of your personal journalistic experience? Have you covered stories related to ISIS and terrorism?
Oh, Lord, yes. Well, I've been in or near, I mean, on the scene of four terrorist attacks over the years. Actually, the first wasn't Middle Eastern. It was the IRA, the Irish. You know, the first people who tried to kill me weren't Muslim. They were Irish Catholics.
Sure.
But I've also, obviously, my background is military and both academic and, you know, serving in the forces. And so it's been a topic I've been dealing with as a journalist for probably getting on for 30 years. And I've kicked around the Middle East a great deal in the course of my career and know some of these guys. And it really is a technique. It is not an ideology. It's a technique. Anybody can use it. You know, you can be Sri Lankan or Northern Irish. It's still available. And it works the same way in whoever's hands it might be. And in every case, in every place, the objective is to panic people. The objective is to panic people and their government into doing something that in one way or another serves the terrorists' purposes. They don't do it because they like the noise.
How many people comprise ISIS? Many of us in the U.S., I think, tend to think there are thousands and thousands of people ready to overrun our borders, to attack Europe as well as the U.S. and Canada, and wreak havoc on us in, you know, the equivalent of a launch from you know, one of the major world powers of in the previous world wars.
No, the scales are different. I mean, you know, on the one hand, the major world wars. A third of a million Americans killed in combat. Everybody's lives eaten up for 4 years by it, and a lot of other countries had 6 years of it. In this case, total American casualties, counting 9/11 and counting all the possibly unnecessary military interventions in the Middle East, under 10,000 over 15 years. that's not the same scale. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as opposed to the German army, the Japanese army, and, you know, for the benefit of giving them the benefit of the doubt, the Italian army, who we were up against in the Second World War, we're up against, in terms of active members now in the Middle East, probably around 175,000 to 100,000 people who could seriously be said to be giving their full time to this job of being in the army that they run in Syria and Iraq, which controls some of the emptier parts of both countries, and all of the people who push the propaganda out on the web to radicalize people elsewhere. In terms of people who might carry out attacks in the West, you're talking low hundreds at the most. Most of those people will never do it or will get caught before they actually get to carry it out. What's left is a big nuisance. I mean, I don't wish to sound cold-blooded. I've been in terrorist attacks, and it's awful. And, you know, every life is valuable. But the numbers of casualties and the real disruption is very low. It's not on the same. It's not like a war. In fact, we should never be treating it as a war. We already have laws against people murdering people and blowing them up, so we don't need to declare a war. We just get on with catching these folks. But that's the whole point of the terrorism, is to inflate the issue, make it an issue that causes you to do large and silly things like invade Iraq.
Well, I was going to ask about the war on terror that was launched by former President George W. Bush following the 9/11 attacks. And we were told as a nation that this is going to be a long, drawn-out war unlike any other war that we've ever fought on this planet. You dismiss that.
Well, you know, for one thing, there weren't any terrorists in Iraq. You know, you're barking up the wrong tree, Mr. Bush. You know, the regime of Saddam Hussein was an extremely unpleasant regime, as many others in the Middle East are and were. But it had nothing to do with Islamist terrorists, the people we worry about. In fact, they were trying to kill him. He was one of their targets. And anybody who wasn't Islamist in Iraq was ideologically committed, and they found out about it, could count on being tortured before they were murdered by the regime. I mean, completely the wrong target. Mm-hmm. If you must go and invade somebody, try to invade somebody who's actually your enemy. It did turn into a long war, but then, you know, thereby hangs a tale, because, as I was saying, you know, the objective of the terrorism is to get your opponent to do something that serves your purposes. What the people who carried out the 9/11 attacks, Mr. Osama bin Laden and his merry men, what they were trying, they were revolutionaries, or Arab revolutionaries trying to come to power in Arab countries. I mean, part of a movement that had already been waging terrorist attacks against Arab regimes for 20 years, and they weren't succeeding in mobilizing the population against the regime. You could trick the regime, the Egyptian regime, the Syrian regime, into getting very brutal, cracking down hard. The theory being that if the government becomes sufficiently hateful, it will push the people into the arms of the revolutionaries, and then you get, you know, the uprising, and the Islamists come to power, and they can put their program into action. Well, it hadn't worked for 20 years, and so along comes Osama bin Laden, who's been up in Afghanistan fighting the Russians for 10 years, and the Russians go home, and he's sitting in a camp in the southern Afghanistan. The Islamists are now coming to power in Afghanistan because they led the resistance movement. He's not going to be part of that because he's not Afghan. He doesn't speak any language in that country. He can't. So what does he do next? And, of course, the objective he's always had is coming to power, bringing his movement, his ideology, to power in Arab countries. To start with, he's an Arab. And it's clear that the strategy that's been working, been attempted for the last 20 years, trying to overthrow Arab regimes by attacking them, getting them to react badly, drive people into the arms of the terrorists, usual kind of technique, hasn't been working. His big idea is what we need is for the United States, any big Western power would do, but the United States is the obvious candidate, to invade. And you see, he's working on a pattern that he's just lived through. The Russians invaded Afghanistan, never mind why it's part of the Cold War. But it's a Muslim country. The Islamists flock up to Afghanistan to help, the Arab Islamists, to help the resistance movement, mainly because it's so frustrating being an Arab revolutionary in Arab countries. At least here you could go and do something useful. They spend 10 years helping to fight the Afghans to fight the Russians. At the end of it, the Russians go home. They've lost 14,000 dead. It's the sort of end of Vietnam scenario. And so bin Laden is sitting in the camps wondering what to do next. And the grand new idea is, why don't we try to duplicate this thing in the whole of the Arab world? We'll get the Americans to invade this time. You can't sucker the Russians into doing it again. And, you know, when they invade, people will rise up to defend Islam, to defend Arab nationalism, whatever. And that is our chance of coming to power. Never mind the revolutions, what we'll have. Well, we'll have a revolution, but it'll be an armed revolution, and it will be driven by the reaction to an American invasion.
Gwen Dyer, an acclaimed Canadian independent journalist, historian, and author based in London, England. His most recent book in 2015, Don't Panic, ISIS Terrorism in Today's Middle East. That was the topic of his Chautauqua lecture on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University on October 20th. I'm John Hingsbergen. Eric Liddell is the coordinator of the Chautauqua series on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University. And Eric, we have another segment from one of the speakers in the series, Joy Harjo.
Yeah, Joy Harjo, Muskegee poet, musician, and educator, currently chair of excellence in creative writing at the University of Tennessee. One of the great poets of our age, in my opinion, as I said earlier. So we were delighted to have her come here to EKU to give a mixture of reading and performance. You know, she combines her own Native American myth and symbol and storytelling with contemporary concerns. And so her presentations are always timeless and immediate. And it was wonderful. So I'm interested to hear what she had to say in the interview clip.
And the topic of her talk, Conflict Resolution for Holy Beings. It was a keynote address for Native American Heritage Month. And I began by asking her, who are these holy beings?
Mm-hmm. It's a book of poetry. And the holy beings are all of us. That title actually was inspired by a Facebook post by a Navajo activist, a theater person, writer, who Norman Brown, who talked about getting up that morning and going out and speaking with, that talked about what his parents would say and, you know, call this, how we were all of us here on Earth are recognized as holy beings.
And why the topic conflict resolution? What type of conflict are you thinking of? Are you talking about conflict among nations, conflict among you know, businesses and their clients, conflict among neighbors in a community, conflict within domestic situation?
It's all of the above. And being a human being is really, we embody conflict. We're born into a world that is dualistic. There's birth, at birth, there's death is present. At death, birth is present. That's the kind of universe we live in, the universe of polarity.
So what do you say about conflict resolution? Are you offering tips and suggestions on how we can do a better job of resolving conflicts?
I don't know that I have any answers, but I can certainly talk or sing or poet about these conflicts and about, I think poetry, the nature of poetry or music in and of itself is that to be able to put something into words, to be able to sound out something makes doorways or makes openings to understanding. So that my talk is basically, it will basically be a performance of speaking, singing, playing music, and addressing conflict resolution, chaos, order. How does chaos talk to order? How do they communicate? How do we find a way in this very politicized time to reach across and speak to each other in a way that's respectful and full of compassion and honesty?
You speak of this very politicized time. What opportunities or what challenges have you personally found in the midst of the chaos, as it were, of this election process for the last year or so?
Oh, yeah, this process is very destructive. I feel that it will be constructive if we can find order out of it, find our way back to a trail in which people can sit at a kitchen table and talk to each other respectfully with no name calling, no greediness to own everything, with no greediness to own everything, including other people's words, or to speak over or own something just because you have the money and the power to do so. I think this election will go down in history as probably, it could be a point where this will lead, it's a breaking point. I think this time in history is a breaking point, because what's decided here is, you know, we have a country, it's got rough beginnings. I mean, we have a country that was essentially 100% indigenous peoples, and with a few hundred years were about 1%, close to 2%, 1.5%. That's like Africa with, you know, being ground down to or massacred to 0.5% Africans. That's what we're dealing with here. And yet, the country, the United States of America, was founded on principles of democracy that were borrowed from indigenous peoples, including the Muscogee people, the Iroquois people. And in that, which comes out of original teachings, is that we are not over everyone. We don't own the land. We don't own the plants, the animals. We all have our place. And we all have our voices, and we all deserve a place at the table.
Joy Harjo, poet, writer, performer, saxophone player of the Muscogee Creek Nation. She spoke on November 3rd before the election on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University as part of the Chautauqua Lecture Series for 2016-2017. We're talking about that series, the general theme of the series, Order and Chaos. Eric Liddell, coordinator of that series, with us in the studio. And we'll be back in just a few moments to talk further with Eric and to meet two other guests who have been on campus this year, Jeremy England and Christian Parenti. Those segments are coming up in just a few moments on Eastern Standard from the WEKU stations. Write to us with your comments, your suggestions at WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKU EST or leave a voicemail 859-622-1657. This week's program, a recorded show, but we're still glad to hear from you. 859-622-1657. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. The 2016-2017 Chautauqua Lecture Series on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University is the topic of this week's special edition of our program. It's a recorded edition of the program. I'm John Hingsberg, and with me in the studio is Eric Liddell, coordinator of the Chautauqua Series on the campus. And we're going to hear from two more of the guests who have spoken so far during this year's fascinating series on order and chaos. And Eric, the segments we heard from Joy Harjo and Gwen Dyer, very informative, and just a tiny little snippet, just a sample of what those folks brought. I assume what we heard here is reflective of what they did during their talks.
It is. Take what you heard, multiply it by 10, 20, 30, you know, to construct the experience of hearing them give a lecture in a live setting and answer questions, which is always, you know, a wonderful part of that experience as well.
Now, I have to admit that the conversation with Jeremy England, who is a physicist, I guess, was a little bit...
It's pretty high level.
Wow. Over my head. But I asked questions anyway.
Over my head as well.
And he continued talking. And I hope our listeners will get something out of it.
Maybe somebody in the feedback section will help us understand it. Well,
entropy and irreversible change, the thermodynamics of evolutionary adaptation.
Right, which is a way of encapsulating Jeremy England's major contribution to physics, which has to do with the theory of the spontaneous generation of life. You know, the way it was described by him in a magazine article that I read is that if you shine an intense light on something for long enough, you get a plant. And this is a way of thinking about early evolution in the cosmos, but also a way of thinking of how we can manufacture lifelike things in the laboratory here and now and into the future. And so he's got his own lab at MIT. He's in his prime as a theoretical physicist and trying to work out implications and applications of his ideas. He may be the next Darwin, as one of his colleagues put it at one point.
Well, listeners, fasten your seatbelt. Here is Jeremy England, Entropy and Irreversible Change, Thermodynamics of Evolutionary Adaptation. His talk was on November 17th.
The title of the talk is probably, in some sense, a red herring, in the sense that I'm going to start off my talk by arguing that maybe we don't need to talk about entropy as much as people sometimes want to, and trying to explain why the world is the way it is. Entropy is an idea from thermodynamics that is sometimes described as sort of a quantity that measures disorder, and we often hear about it in the context of the second law of thermodynamics, which if you try to sort of express it in everyday parlance, sometimes boils down to the idea that everything is supposed to be getting more and more and more disordered over time. But then the other foot drops, and we notice somehow that in the course of that tendency of the world getting less and less ordered, there should also somehow be a reason why orderly things like life come into being. And it becomes kind of a confused mess to our intuitions, I think, to talk about it in those terms. That's because really entropy is kind of a formal concept that we only have in our lexicon for somewhat historical reasons, having to do with what people were first doing when they studied heat engines back in the day and figuring out thermodynamics. So really, I think what is important about the concept of entropy is just that it's a number that counts the ways that you can put things together. So if I have a collection of particles and I'm trying to figure out the number of different ways of arranging them, where I could put one here and one there and I could make something of one shape or another shape, it's a matter of counting different ways that something can happen. And the reason people talk about entropy in physics is because it's usually related to a quantity that I think that we're probably more interested in, which is probability. We're trying to estimate the likelihood of different things happening. The research in my lab at MIT is about trying to use some of those concepts of predicting likelihood in systems where we have clear physical assumptions that we're making about the laws that govern them, applying that prediction of likelihood to think about the likelihood of the emergence of behaviors in systems that we think of as being lifelike behaviors, distinctively lifelike behaviors.
Your talk title, Entropy and Irreversible Change. What kind of irreversible change are we talking about? Are we talking about something we can see, or just merely something you scientists can see in a laboratory?
So the word irreversible is being used in a technical way in that title. And what it refers to is really something that we're quite familiar with in everyday experience, which is that there are some things that happen in the world that look perfectly normal when they happen one way, and they would look very abnormal if they ran backwards, if we saw the sort of movie rewind of that event happening. So you know, you can see a lion eat a gazelle on a nature film and think that looks totally natural and normal, but you don't see lions regurgitate bits of gazelles that reassemble themselves back into a healthy animal that skips away backwards onto the savannah. That is kind of an absurd thing to point out until you start getting into the details of what we think are good models for how the physical materials out of which these things are made interact with each other. Because if you look at Newton's laws, or you look at the generalizations of Newton's laws that we think are good theories for how physical substances work, there's a basic, what's called a symmetry in those equations of motion, which seems to say that there should be ways for things to go forwards and backwards. So I can drop a ball and have it fall to the ground, or I can throw a ball up in the air from the ground and have it go back up to where it would have been dropped from before, and both of those are equally allowable. So when it comes to simple things, it's very easy to see the ball go down or to see the ball go up. But then when there are certain complex things in the world that we see, suddenly there's a forward and a reverse, and they're recognizably different. And so I'm referring to irreversible change in the title because our understanding of thermodynamics is that whenever you see that irreversibility, whenever you see something that looks normal going one way and not the other way, that's the signature of a flow of energy going on in the exchange between the thing you're looking at and its surroundings. So, for example, if I put a seed in a pot and the seed grows into a plant and I find that to be normal, but seeing the plant ungrow back into a seed is not, the reason in a physical sense for that breaking of the symmetry between those two movies is that the seed, as it's growing into the plant, is absorbing sunlight and then releasing that energy back into its surroundings as heat. And there's, so there's a directional flow of energy that is kind of going on somewhat invisibly that is creating the illusion of that, the breaking of that symmetry.
Jeremy England, Entropy and Irreversible Change, the Thermodynamics of Evolutionary Adaptation. England is assistant professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Some have described him as the next Darwin, and fascinating conversation. I don't know if our listeners are able to follow it, but I thought, well, there's some interesting words there.
We're not afraid of technical details at Chautauqua.
Apparently,
we get into the weeds as well as the big ideas.
Eric Liddell is coordinator of the Chautauqua Lecture Series, the guy who makes sure that these things happen and invites these folks to campus each year. And another person that we spoke with during the past number of months was Christian Parenti, talking about war and development in the age of climate change. This was the International Studies keynote address.
Well, Christian Parenti, like Gwyn Dyer, whom we already heard, is an award-winning historian and journalist who has spent a lot of time on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan and many other places around the world doing his research about global politics, about climate change, about the potential effects on societies around the world of those things. And, you know, he brings a sociological and human geography perspective to these things and such a critique to bear upon these issues. And yeah, he was here to give a really great talk after the election. So he talked a lot about, you know, possible implications of the Trump presidency.
December 1st, Christian Parenti, War and Development in the Age of Climate Change, International Studies keynote address.
My last book, Tropic of Chaos, argues that climate change is already a driving factor in war, in civil war primarily, and other types of violence. So that's part of it. And part of the solution to climate change, I argue, is a different kind of development is needed. A lot of environmentalists argue that essentially what is needed is a type of economic or developmental retreat. And I'm arguing what we need is a qualitative transformation, but actually dealing with the climate crisis requires a whole new round of development, of investment and technology deployment and creation and growth. One response to that is, oh, well, then there just has to be more intervention and more militarism, and ultimately that's not going to work. And what needs to happen is we have to have mitigation and adaptation. Mitigation means we have to get off fossil fuels. We have to mitigate the causes of climate change, which is the loading of into the atmosphere of greenhouse gases, primarily CO2. And adaptation is how do people adapt to the physical, economic, and environmental changes that climate change will bring and is already bringing. And there's different paths of adaptation. Part of what I argue in the book is that picking up the gun in much of the global south is a form of adaptation for people. It's a bad form of adaptation. And the global north should not respond to these crises with more armed adaptation. But we have to really deal with the underlying problems and mitigate the center of the problem, which is emissions, by shifting, by driving an energy transition, energy revolution. And
is that what you're saying when you talk about the folks in the global south picking up the gun? That is, these are revolutionary actions against the oppressive governments that are not allowing the citizenry to benefit from development? Or?
They're not really, you know, what I argue in the book is that there's some of that. I mean, one example in the book is a revolutionary effort in India by these Maoist guerrillas, the Naxalites. But there are also religious reactions, ethnic conflict. It's not as coherent as addressing the issue of social justice. It's more like people adapting at different scales and different ways. So the book opens with how cattle herders in East Africa are adapting, and as drought and extreme weather is causing their herds to die, well, what do they do? They're not waging a revolution against the government of Kenya. They're attacking each other. They're trying to steal their neighbor's cattle. And, you know, part of that's a traditional pattern. The cattle raiding has gone on since time immemorial in East Africa, but it has become more intense because the landscape is now littered with cheap weaponry as a result of the Cold War. And there's also more weaponry flowing in, particularly in through Somalia, as what was a Cold War theater has now morphed into a war on terror theater. Somalia collapsed because it was a frontline state where the Soviet Union and the U.S., through their proxies, were pouring weapons in, and there was a war between Ethiopia and Somalia, and it led to the collapse of Somalia. Out of that chaos emerges al-Shabaab, this Islamist revolutionary millenarian formation, and into that now flows more weapons, and then out of Somalia into Kenya flow those same weapons. So there's different causes to the violence. It's not as coherent as though people are rebelling.
What I'm not hearing you mention is the development that has gone on, for instance, in China, where the business and industrial development has occurred, and there's a lot of energy usage and the use of fossil fuels, and the air is unbreathable, mm-hmm. obviously contributing to mm-hmm. Global climate change. Mm-hmm. To what extent does that come into play here?
Well, I don't actually deal with in the book. I don't deal with China because there's really not much violence. It's not a story of collapse and failure and violence, but of, at least in the short term, rather amazing economic success. So yeah, that is a major problem for the planet. How are the developing economies of the global South going to meet their energy needs? And we're at a crossroads here where the question is there going to be an energy transition to renewable sources or not? And the good news from China, we hear a lot of bad news, but the good news is that they are making really significant investments in renewable energy. And it's not because they have some grand environmental vision that they're trying to fulfill. It's partly the same reason that we in the United States started regulating industry in the late 60s and early 70s. It was really under Nixon in the early 70s when this really kicks off. It was because local air and water quality had gotten so bad that there were these broad coalitions of people who demanded some sort of action. I mean, as late as, I believe it was like 1967, there was a smog inversion in New York City in which, people died. So it's out of that came the Environmental Protection Agency, the Clean Air Act, all that sort of stuff. Similarly, in China right now, they have airpocalypse, as it's called, also in India, where the local air quality is so bad, they can't get CEOs and executives from foreign companies to come live in Beijing because it's just unbreathable. And you have to pay hazard pay to diplomatic staff and corporate staff to go and live in these cities. There's protests by poor people. There's protests by wealthy elites in China. This has to be dealt with. And as a result of that, they're building out actually enormous amounts of solar and wind power. It's not fast enough. And they are kind of rolling back the coal. So part of the question in terms of an energy transition that is put on the table by the Trump election victories, who's going to lead this transition, right? Africa, with almost 1 billion people, has enormous energy demands coming online. And the question is, okay, are there going to be coal-fired power plants built? Is Africa going to finally fully electrify by doing what the U.S. did in the 1920s and 30s, or is it going to use renewable energy? There's a lot of investment in renewable energy, and the Chinese are getting far more of the market share than American firms. And so, there's been a perennial question: what is the U.S. going to take this global challenge seriously or not? I didn't have much faith that Hillary Clinton, a Clinton administration, would do that, and that's because I watched closely what the Obama administration did. And the Obama administration, despite its rhetoric and despite the claims of the critics of the Obama administration that painted it as some sort of socialist tree-hugging administration, the Obama administration was not very green. It opened the Arctic to drilling. offshore oil drilling. It opened the East Coast to offshore drilling, and it opened the West Coast to offshore drilling. It opened large parts of federal lands were open. So I didn't have much hope for a Clinton administration. But the Trump administration, on the other hand, clearly Trump has taken a much harder line against climate change. He has said it's a Chinese hoax, but he's also said that it's serious and he believes in it. He's taken every single position, but the person who's running his EPA transition, Edel, is a climate denier. He does not accept the science, and every other appointment that he has made thus far indicates that there's going to be an attempt to gut the accumulated regulations that have developed around the environment since the 1970s.
Christian Parenti talking about the war and development in the age of climate change, and that talk as part of the EKU Chautauqua Lecture Series December 1st of 2016. With me in the studio, Eric Liddell, coordinator of the Chautauqua Lecture Series on campus at Eastern Kentucky University. We're about midway through this year's series. What's up next?
What's on tap right away is the Chautauqua National Juried Art Exhibition. It runs until February 22nd in the Giles Gallery of the Campbell Building here on the EKU campus. And there will be an opening reception tonight. That's Thursday, January 26th from 5 to 7 p.m. So come on out. We've got 73 works by 58 artists from 26 states. I'm told it's our largest exhibition ever at the Giles Gallery. And we've got, of course, a full slate of speakers throughout the term, starting with February 9th, Bianca Spriggs, Afro-Latian poet, giving the keynote address for National Black History Month.
And what's on tap for 2017-2018? Do we know the theme yet?
The theme is likely to have to do with change, adaptation, and transformation.
Eric Liddell, coordinator for the Chautauqua Lecture Series at Eastern Kentucky University. Thank you once again for bringing us the Chautauqua Series and for being with us on Eastern Standard.
It's been my pleasure, John. Thanks for the opportunity.
Our associate producers for Eastern Standard are Marissa Hempel, Brian Burkhart, and Noah Day. I'm John Hingsbergen, thanking you for being part of the program. The show repeats on Sunday evening at 6 o'clock, and you can find a podcast of it online at our website at weku.fm. We're interested in hearing from you. Write to us anytime, weku eastern standard at gmail.com.